From CAFE, this is United Security. I'm Ken Weinstein. Hello, folks. It's Ken Weinstein from United Security. Today, we have another special interview. As you recall, 4 weeks ago, we did an interview with John Brennan, the former CIA director. And today, we have Matt Olson. Matt is the former director of the National Counterterrorism Center, and he's here today to talk to us about his career in national security. Good to see you, Matt. How are you today?
I'm good. It's great to be here, Ken. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. It's our pleasure. Today, as I said, we're going to talk about your career in national security, what you've done, what trends you've seen over the years that you've been working in the vineyards of national security. But why don't you start off by telling us what it is you're doing now? What job have you landed at this point?
So yeah, I left the government 6 years ago, just over 6 years ago, 2014. And I am now at Uber. I am the chief trust and security officer at Uber. I have responsibility for our cybersecurity program, as well as physical security and law enforcement interaction and investigations. So it's been a significant transition. You know, a lot of times I am asked about the transition from government, where I had spent 24 years in a number of different roles, to the hurly-burly world of Silicon Valley and technology companies. But yeah, no, it's been terrific. Uber's a great company and I've enjoyed it.
Yeah, and the hurly-burly world of a technology company in the middle of a pandemic. I assume that's been a special challenge.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, not unique to Uber. We're all going through it together. But it's a special challenge in the sense that, at least for me and on our team, you know, we had to help sort of transition the company from everyone being together in the workplace to everybody trying to work at home. One of the challenges there was just, how do you do that with thousands and thousands, tens of thousands of employees who are now working at home, and make sure that they're working, they're able to work securely over their laptops as opposed to in an office environment.
Yeah, sounds like you have your work cut out for you. So look, we could go on for a whole podcast just about that, but let's rewind and go back in time a little bit. And I actually think before we proceed, we should probably, as a matter of full disclosure, explain to our listeners that we've known each other for a while. Do you remember when we first met?
Yeah, of course. And I totally agree. It's something that would be a conspicuous omission if we didn't tell folks that we went to college together and have known each other since second year at the University of Virginia.
Yeah, since 1981, when I had a cheesy 1980s mustache. You had your hair parted in the middle, a lot like John Travolta.
I had hair. So that was, I would trade my current situation for a middle part any day.
So we go back quite a long way. And I guess we could tell stories about our times together in college, but probably that wouldn't be appropriate. I think we'll stick with national security. So it's been great actually sort of traveling the career path with you over these years. So why don't I just give a sort of capsule summary, why don't you give us a capsule summary of the places you've been in government? You graduated from UVA, then graduated from Harvard Law School, clerked in the DC District Court, same time I did. And then you went to a law firm for a short stint, and then you entered DOJ. So why don't you just sort of walk us through where you've been, and then we'll go back and look at each stage of your career in more depth.
Sure. I appreciate the opportunity to talk about, you know, the work I did and the opportunities I had. Do tend to help, you know, provide sort of a framework or opportunity to talk about some of the issues that are more interesting than my career, really. It's the issues and the challenges that we faced that I think are so interesting. But, you know, the other thing, Ken, is not only did we go to college together, but our time as government employees and Justice Department in particular employees has been intertwined as well. So you know, it's not like we went to college together and then separated and we're coming together today for the podcast, obviously.
Yeah. So I might know a lot, large parts of the story. So if I just get up and get a beer while you're talking, I'll understand.
Yeah. It's going to take, you know, all of this. So I entered the Justice Department in the Civil Rights Division in the voting section. I was really interested in working on voting cases and civil rights in particular. I spent a couple years doing that. And then I went over to the U.S. Attorney's Office in D.C., where I spent 12 years. Did a lot of different types of work in the U.S. Attorney's Office, from, you know, drug cases to homicide cases to gang cases to public corruption cases. But I also spent a couple of years during that time on detail to the FBI, working for Director Mueller in 2004 and 2005. And it's really that experience that sort of put me on the path more of working in national security. And I worked in a number of roles in the Justice Department.
So one of the themes I think that your career kind of illustrates is the intersection of law enforcement operations and national security operations that we've seen over the last 20 years or so. You know, so you start out as a federal prosecutor doing federal crimes as well as, you know, the regular sort of street level crimes that you prosecute in the DC U.S. Attorney's Office, because unlike other U.S. Attorney's Offices, the DC office is both the federal prosecutor as well as the local prosecutor. So you're doing sort of meat and potatoes criminal prosecutions, and then you progress into the national security space. And so in some ways, you actually have lived the intersection of law enforcement and national security, like others, like myself and like Lisa Monaco, who, as you know, is the other half of this podcast. And by the way, she sends her best and her regrets that she couldn't be here today. But that, I think, is sort of an interesting intersection. And I think it's important for people to understand how law enforcement and national security operations were relatively distinct operations within our government prior to 9/11, distinct both operationally in terms of personnel being devoted to the two different disciplines and culturally. I want to speak to that for a minute, and then you can speak to how that changed after 9/11.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a great observation. And I think you're right that Lisa, for sure, and you and I, you know, sort of live this experience of the intersection of law enforcement and national security. We have similar backgrounds, having been prosecutors and then transitioned to the national security world. And it's like a lot of folks, Ken, you know, 9/11 was a defining moment for so many Americans, so many people around the world. But for lawyers in the Justice Department, it became an imperative, right? To see how do you participate and contribute to this, you know, really such a substantial challenge at the time, at that sort of post 9/11 period. And as you said, sort of before 9/11, when we were prosecutors in the Justice Department, we didn't really focus on national security. I mean, there were a handful of cases involving terrorist attacks, some from the 70s and 80s, you know, hijackings. But most of national security didn't involve law enforcement, did not involve prosecution, didn't really involve law. I mean, if you look now at universities, I know you teach at Georgetown a national security law class, you know, like when we were in law school, and I do too. And when we were in law school, there were no national security law programs or law journals. There was no national security law class. That is such a major change now, where you see lots and lots of interest, because this field of national security law largely developed after 9/11 in the, you know, sort of the crucible of the challenges posed by a terrorist attack inside the United States on the scale of the 9/11 attacks. So we sort of experienced, you know, in real time, that transition. Particularly at the FBI, when the FBI was transitioning from its pre-9/11 posture to its post-9/11 posture as a organization focused on defending the country from a terrorist attack. And, you know, similarly, I had that experience at the FBI and also within the National Security Division at Justice, of how we were going to transition those organizations that had not traditionally prioritized national security into making them, you know, so that was the number one priority for those organizations.
Right. So I think one of the advantages that we have had is that we got a grounding back, you know, in the 90s in building criminal cases. And, you know, the discipline of building a criminal case is different from the discipline of collecting and analyzing intelligence for purposes of advising policymakers. In the former, you're putting together information that will be hopefully developed into evidence that will then constitute sufficient basis to prosecute a case. In the latter, you're pulling together information to try to give yourself a better understanding of the intelligence about a threat to the United States to advise policymakers. Two different disciplines, two different types of activity, but they draw on the same skills, the same general skill set. And so tell us what, just sort of briefly, the area that you focused on. You focused on developing sophisticated conspiracy cases against gangs, especially very violent gangs that were wreaking havoc on the streets of DC back in the 90s. And tell us about some of the skill sets that you and others were able to develop that were then helpful when you made that transition into intelligence or national security operations.
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And I think it's an important insight that you just provided, that there's real differences between law enforcement, criminal, prosecutions and national security and intelligence collection and analysis, important differences, but there's some really fundamental similarities. And the building blocks for both of those disciplines, both of those trade crafts are very similar. So when I came up in the U.S. Attorney's Office, one of the biggest cases I worked on was a gang case involving a violent street gang in Washington, D.C., responsible for literally dozens of murders over the course of a decade. To make that case required, you know, basically several years of investigation by the FBI and by the Metropolitan Police Department. But the techniques of that investigation, you know, you can easily see how they looks like an intelligence investigation or intelligence work. It was developing sources, getting to know exactly who had information about what was going on in those neighborhoods that were plagued by that gang. We had wiretaps. You know, what this sort of one of the building blocks of any intelligence investigation is surveillance, electronic surveillance. Well, that was what we used in the criminal case. We used multiple wiretaps to listen in on their phone calls. Other ways of identifying things that they didn't want us to learn about, watching them, you know, observation, search warrants. And ultimately, then the analysis tradecraft is where the similarities are the greatest from the perspective of having been a prosecutor. That is, being able to, you know, judge information. How reliable is it? Who's it coming from? Do they have a bias? Are they getting paid? Do they see themselves as part of one side or the other? Actually trying to build cooperation from an individual who's not inclined to cooperate with the United States or with the prosecutor, you know, getting their trust, offering them something that's of value to them, typically leniency in a criminal case, and then being a really skeptical and, you know, practiced analysis, having that ability to really analyze information very carefully to make sure that by the time you're presenting it to a decision maker, in a criminal case, that's a jury. In an intelligence matter, it's a policymaker. But being prepared to stand behind your judgments, to disclose weaknesses and be forthcoming about those. I mean, those are skills that apply across the board to both law enforcement and intelligence matters.
Right. So I think, you know, historically, and we could do a whole podcast devoted just to this issue, but historically there was this sense that these were two distinct disciplines. People had their skill sets that matched the demands of each discipline, and oftentimes the twain never met. When in fact, I think when 9/11 happened and the laws changed that allowed and actually forced more coordination and integration between our law enforcement personnel, who were at that time, we were focused on terrorists, who were looking for terrorists as possible defendants in criminal matters, coordination between those folks, and also the intelligence officials who were looking at terrorist suspects as intelligence targets. The two of those groups were able to coordinate much better than I think people anticipated that they would, because the skill sets they used really were the same skill set, just used on for sort of different purposes. So that's one of the reasons why I think the integration that we've seen since 9/11, what I think has been a pretty clear success story of the government being able to shift gears and really meet the national security needs of our country over the last 20 years. That's one of the reasons why we've seen that success, I believe.
I totally agree. And, you know, I think there has been a sense, I think, historically, that these are two separate worlds. And 9/11 really compelled, you know, the CIA and the FBI and the Justice Department and all these organizations, DOD, to sort of confront this challenge of melding these two worlds. And you now, if you talk to the CIA officers or the FBI agents who've worked counterterrorism since 9/11, they speak, you know, basically the same language. They have relationships that go, you know, very deep and far beyond, I think, what people may have anticipated could have been achieved right after 9/11, when there was this sense that these two organizations and these two worlds had not been sufficiently integrated and worked well enough together. And I think it is one of the lesser recognized successes of the post 9/11 period, is this breaking down of these barriers between these two worlds working in an integrated fashion, a coordinated fashion to go after terrorists.
Okay, so back to your personal story. So here it is, 2004. You've had great success with a number of our colleagues in putting together some of these gang cases that really rid the streets of DC of many serious violent gang members. And then you get talked into coming over to the FBI and be a counsel to Mueller. And as I recall, I might have had something to do with that. I think I talked you into it. and said, we're going to have a great time together.
Yeah, my favorite part about this story is that this is right. This is actually May of 2004. I remember very well, Ken was chief of staff to Bob Mueller and said, you know, why don't you leave your nice supervisor job in the U.S. Attorney's office where you know everything, you're very comfortable, and come over to the FBI where you know almost nobody, but don't worry about it. I'm here and I can help show you the ropes.
I got your back.
I literally did. We didn't work one day together. I started on a Monday, the same day that at the FBI, the same day that you went back to become the U.S. attorney in D.C. So I was completely on my own.
I bailed on you.
And you bailed on me. And it wasn't either the first time and it wasn't the last time that you pulled that trick.
Totally guilty. So I left you there to face Bob Mueller all on your own. And the two of you guys became a great team. So why don't you tell us a little bit about what you did? Once again, this is 2004. Not that long after 9/11, and you came into the front office, the FBI. What was the Bureau focused on at that point?
Yeah, it was, you know, it was a fascinating time to work at the FBI. It was, you know, laser focused on counterterrorism, and Director Mueller focused like no one else can on the sort of transformation of the FBI into a, you know, world-class national security organization. So among other things, you know, the 9/11 commission report was issued while I was there, something you had worked on very closely. And Director Mueller, you know, I think deserves the credit that he's largely gotten for the way he handled the commission, and very open, very straightforward, owned up to the challenges within the FBI, the problems, but put forward a very compelling case to maintain the FBI as a sort of unified crime fighting and national security organization, which was not a, you know, not an obvious conclusion that was going to be reached. There was real conversation around breaking it apart.
Right. When the 9/11 Commission first kicked off, they were talking about breaking the FBI apart into a separate intelligence organization and a separate crime-fighting organization, which would have been devastating to the FBI and really would have negated one of the great advantages of the FBI, which is that it can bring both intelligence and criminal tools to bear in the fight against foreign threats like terrorists.
Exactly. I mean, just what we've been talking about, how those two worlds can be integrated if it's done effectively. But I look, so that was in play. And then the 9/11 Commission report came out while I was there. And so I was part of the response to that with Director Mueller. And then the other big commission report was the WMD Commission report came out. And also during that time, the Office of the Director of National Intelligence was stood up, the Intelligence Reform Act. Terrorism Protection and Reform Act was passed in 2004. So all of these pretty significant events happened during my 2 years or so at the FBI, where the FBI was responding and driving a lot of that change with Director Mueller at the helm.
Let me ask about one thing you mentioned. You mentioned the WMD report. That's a bit of a misnomer. That's the popular name for that effort, but it was the Rob Silverman report or inquiry into our intelligence operations in the aftermath of what was perceived as an intelligence failure around the Iraq War, or that led to the Iraq War, you know, the curveball information. And Judge Silverman and Senator Robb led a commission that went back and reviewed our intelligence operations. And I just raise this because it sort of goes back to the blocking and tackling of information analysis that you described earlier, which is what is done both on the criminal side and on the national security side. And they had some very important recommendations, but one of them, to jump ahead in our story, was to create the National Security Division, which you and I ended up joining together.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because you're right. The WMD Commission focused on intelligence failures around the WMD in Iraq, but it really was a much more profound and fundamental analysis of some of the challenges around intelligence and intelligence failures. But you know, one of the key points I think that goes forward to today is that intelligence needs to be nonpartisan, apolitical, and beyond the influence or pressure of politics. You know, that's something that I think has been an enduring challenge, right? When you talk about serious policy consequences to these intelligence findings, this is just something I think it's worth always bearing in mind. And that was part of what the WMD Commission looked at. But as you said, Ken, it also, I remember very well the WMD Commission report said that basically the entire U.S. government has reorganized around counterterrorism with the exception of one organization, and that's the Department of Justice, which still has its counterterrorism and national security organizations fragmented and separated into a number of different components of the department. And it's time that that changed. And that led, as you said, to the creation of the National Security Division.
Right. So just to use that as a pivot into the next stage of your career. So the WND report recommended that the prosecutors, the criminal prosecutors within DOJ, who were prosecuting national security crimes like espionage and terrorism, international terrorism, be merged with the attorneys within the Justice Department who were working with the FBI agents to get FISA's Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act orders that allowed for surveillance on the intelligence side of the ledger. In other words, surveillances for intelligence investigations. The report recommended that those two groups of DOJ attorneys should be in the same component, should be talking with each other, should be sharing information gleaned from intelligence investigations with information gleaned from criminal investigations so that we could have a full picture of our adversaries. And that, as you said, is the merging or the integrating of intelligence and law enforcement that had happened throughout the government, but ironically didn't happen at DOJ until this recommendation was made. Congress, the president accepted that recommendation, proposed it to Congress, and Congress passed the law in 2006 that stood up the National Security Division. So when that law got passed, you were back at the U.S. Attorney's Office. You and I were teamed up in the U.S. Attorney's Office, and you came in and headed up our new National Security section within the U.S. Attorney's Office, which was focusing on national security criminal cases. And then 2006, you and I got the nod to go over to NSD. So why don't you tell us a little bit about the transition over to NSD and what kind of things we focused on and sort of maybe how we were structured a little bit.
It was a really amazing opportunity to go to Maine Justice. You know, folks who are listening who know what it's like to be a prosecutor in the U.S. Attorney's Office, you know, that's really, you're on the front lines, you know, you're out in the field and you have a lot of autonomy and it's really a fantastic way to work as a prosecutor. But Maine Justice is really responsible for more of the policy and coordination of what goes on around the country on behalf of the Justice Department. And the new National Security Division was, Ken, I think it was like the first new division in decades, maybe 40 years or something like that.
Yeah, I think it was like 50 years since the establishment of the Civil Rights Division back in the 60s.
Yeah, so now for the first time, you have this sort of stodgy and traditional Department of Justice, you know, which has been resistant to that kind of organizational change for all those years, standing up a brand new division that was going to be at the center of a lot of activity, you know, at that time in government, which was the sort of national security and counterterrorism mission. And there was an amazing set of attorneys who, as you can imagine, who had been working and who had gone to work on these issues at Justice in the counterterrorism section, the counterespionage section, and what was then known as the Office of Intelligence Policy and Review, who the group of lawyers who handled all of the intelligence surveillance or FISAs that were being brought before the special court, the FISA court. And so anyway, all of these attorneys, which had been separated out in the old Department of Justice, were now brought together. And you and I, you as the new Assistant Attorney General for National Security, were helping to lead this major change. And at a time of, you know, where there's just a ton of focus on these issues in the government.
Right. So you headed up the group of attorneys who were working on the FISAs, Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, and working with the FISA court in terms of applying for surveillance authority and then obtaining court orders that allowed for that surveillance authority. So, and then Pat Rowan, a good friend of ours, headed up the side of the National Security Division, NSD, that had the criminal prosecutors who were actively prosecuting terrorism and espionage cases and the like. So there was a lot of activity in the FISA front in the years that you were in NSD. First thing I'd just like to ask you about is, as we walked in the door, there was this thing called the Terrorist Surveillance Program, and it was on its last legs, and something had to be done with it. So why don't you tell us a little bit about that story?
Folks who are listening may have heard or know about the Terrorist Surveillance Program. This was a program that was put in place almost immediately after 9/11, involving essentially warrantless surveillance by the National Security Agency, authorized by the president. And it was carried out outside of the framework of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act a law that had been passed in 1978 to regulate the surveillance of U.S. persons, essentially U.S. citizens, for intelligence purposes. But in the context of the post 9/11 period, the president had made the decision to authorize surveillance of U.S. persons in some cases and others, but without going through the strictures and processes set that had been set up under the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act.
And this is electronic surveillance, like of phones and emails and the like, right?
Exactly. This is electronic surveillance or surveillance over the, phone and email. This was done in a highly classified manner. In fact, it was sort of beyond the usual levels of classification. It was very, very few people in the government knew about it. It went by a code name that until 2013, we would never have been able to talk about on a podcast. And then certainly I had been at the FBI and I had been doing national security cases in the government, but it had not heard about it. So this was not a very well-known program. It was really very closely held to just the operators who were running it and a handful of lawyers in the Justice Department and at the White House. It was in, I think, December of 2005 that there was a New York Times story that disclosed the broad outlines of this program. And that disclosure led to, fair to say, it's pretty strong outcry from different quarters, from members of the press, from civil liberties groups, from privacy groups, from American citizens who were concerned about this activity by the government and that it was a overreach and possibly illegal. We didn't really, no one asked us, I think, Ken, I mean, at least in the time of going into the National Security Division, whether we thought it was a lawful program or not. What they asked us to do was to take the program, at least the kind of capacity or capabilities that it enabled, the types of surveillance that it enabled, and to look to bring it before the FISA court, to bring it in under the rubric of FISA, or to try to get the law changed, FISA changed, in order to enable, again, the type of collection that was being carried out under the terrorist surveillance program.
Yeah, I think that's fair. The marching orders were these surveillances, the surveillance authority that's being exercised under the terrorist surveillance program is important for our national security. And it does not seem to be sustainable in the long run under the authority that the president had invoked with the terrorist surveillance program right after 9/11. And so it was our job to work with the Office of Legal Counsel within the Justice Department to look into whether and how we could get it brought under FISA court authority so that it was fully authorized and supervised by the FISA court, therefore being operated consistent with FISA and therefore without any legal concern. And that was the first, I think, our first big mission. You took point on that. And I think in January, the Attorney General was able to announce that any surveillances that had been conducted under the terrorist surveillance program that were still ongoing were now ongoing under the authority of the FISA court.
Right. And, this was something I did with a number of other really, really smart, talented folks within the National Security Division who really knew FISA very well, as they'd been working on FISA as a statute for many, many years, as well as some newcomers into the front office, Ken, who served with us in the front office of the National Security Division. But I think it's important to understand, this was legal work that was kind of on the cutting edge. Like, we were trying to come up with legal theories that were largely untested that we were putting forward to the FISA court, which itself is it's a court that meets typically almost exclusively in secret in classified hearings. And we were, interpreting the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act as well as the Fourth Amendment, and positing a theory that we were able to work with, the judges on the FISA court, at least for a period of time, to successfully continue much of what had been done previously under the terrorist surveillance program, but was now done under a very strict regimen of judicial oversight and also congressional oversight. Sort of all three bodies of government now, all three branches of government now having a direct role in overseeing this activity. But as this was not sort of the end game. The end game was ultimately to see if there was a way to modify FISA in order to adjust the law to bring it up to speed with changes in technology that had occurred over the past, you know, 20 years before.
Right. And I think it's important for people to recognize that the reason for the terrorist surveillance program to begin with was the concern that the FISA statute that, as you said, was passed back in 1978, was drafted in a way that was actually technology dependent. It was drafted and its requirements were based on the technology that was used or being used for the communications that were to be surveilled. Now, of course, technology changes by the day, and it had certainly changed dramatically from 1978 to 2001. And as a result of that, those changes, many more surveillances than Congress initially intended were now being brought under the terms of the FISA statute, and therefore were required the government to go to the FISA court to get approval to do those surveillances. Whereas initially when Congress passed FISA and passed it with the technology of the day, it was assuming that a good number of the surveillances that were being conducted in 2001 would not require the government to put together a 60-page application and go to the FISA court, but rather it could just be done without court approval. Because of those changes in technology, when 9/11 happened and the government needed to really expand its surveillances to prevent the next wave of attacks that they expected from Al-Qaeda, it just wasn't doable because the government just didn't have the bandwidth to put together all those applications. So the terrorist surveillance program was the answer. It was to allow those surveillances to be done without going through the court process under a legal theory. But that's at the end of the day, it circumvented the FISA process. But, you know, even once we got to the point in 2007 of bringing the surveillances of the terrorist surveillance program under FISA court order, as you point out, the underlying problem was still there, the underlying problem with the FISA statute. So next step for you was to focus on bringing to Congress a bill or proposed legislation that would fix FISA so that we didn't get back to the same problem that necessitated the terrorist surveillance program in the first place. So which the government succeeded, or the executive branch and Congress succeeded in doing when they passed the FISA Reform Act in the summer of 2008. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the back and forth of Congress and the creation of the FISA Reform Act?
Again, this was the early days of the National Security Division. And really, it's in some ways, it's exactly why the division was established. And that was to have a reservoir of expertise, legal policy expertise on these types of issues. So I was, you know, I was part of a team that was at the time briefing Congress, particularly the House and Senate Intelligence Committees, on how the law was being interpreted, the work we had done with the FISA court, and sort of keeping them apprised of the sort of aftermath of the terrorist surveillance program and the way the court had gotten involved. But at the same time, making the case to members of Congress that the law, as you said, Ken, the law was largely outdated. And as a consequence of its dependence on technology, that was no longer really applicable to much of the types of communications that the government wanted to collect. The government was getting, you know, full FISA, essentially orders or warrants for individuals who really weren't necessarily entitled to that level of protection. So non-U.S. citizens who were outside the United States and who were communicating with other people, other non-U.S. citizens outside the United States. So the argument that we brought to Congress was, you know, let's get back to the original intent of FISA. Let's restore it to where it's focused on, you know, the Fourth Amendment rights of U.S. persons and people in the United States, but allow the government to have more agility in conducting surveillance of people who aren't entitled to those constitutional protections of search and seizure, people, non-U.S. citizens who are having communications outside of the country. Not that that would occur without some oversight or some court involvement. We made a proposal that would involve the FISA court and involve Congress in overseeing that program, but wouldn't require individualized court orders for every one of those efforts to conduct surveillance. And that was essentially the argument that we made, and that was successful. I mean, there was really broad agreement in Congress that that made a lot of sense, and FISA was amended in 2008. And now what sometimes you hear referred to as Section 702 of FISA is the law that's been, you know, really, I think, highly successful from a intelligence collection standpoint, but also successful from a privacy and civil liberties protection standpoint.
Yeah, so the FISA Amendments Act comes in, is passed in the summer of 2008. And as you say, it made that fix that that was such a problem and had bedeviled the executive branch since 2001. It also provided some more oversight and more protections. One example being that it for the first time, it imposed FISA obligations on U.S. persons when they're outside the country. So it actually increased FISA court authority and oversight in certain areas. And as you said, it was a shining example of how Congress, both parties, both sides of the aisle, can work together, especially when it comes to national security. Because, you know, this was a situation where this was not long after 9/11, and people still remembered the urgency of the need to track down the people who were responsible for 9/11, both to mete out justice, but also to protect, to prevent the next attack. And so members of both parties really rolled up their sleeves and worked together and came up with what was a very balanced piece of legislation that was good for national security and good for civil liberties. So I think that's actually a good, very good example of Congress being able to address a national security need. So that passes in summer of 2008. The Bush administration comes to an end pretty soon after that, and you end up being the Assistant Attorney General for National Security. And then soon after that, you get asked to deal with this one minor little issue that should be easy to solve, and that was to close Guantanamo. So why don't you tell us about that issue and how you got the assignment to get Guantanamo closed.
To be clear, I was the acting Assistant Attorney General for National Security for just that period of time, right, during the transition from the Bush administration to the Obama administration. Because I, at the time, this is the tradition, by the way, in the Justice Department, probably, I assume other departments where the senior career person, I was a career civil servant, but the senior career person sort of keeps the lights on for that period of time between the appointment, the nomination and confirmation of a new political leader, because that position is a Senate-confirmed job, the head of the National Security Division. So Obama is elected and comes into office, and I served as the acting AAG. And then I was effectively sort of thinking about what was next, you know, for me. And this is, I don't know if this is a lesson, you know, a cautionary tale or a tale that's a positive one, but one of the biggest issues on the plate for President Obama and the new team was Guantanamo and what to do with the detainees there in the detention facility. In fact, if you recall, Ken, that it was a day one executive order for President Obama to close Guantanamo detention facility in 1 year. So, in sort of in need of a good job, I put my hand up to help work on that. And yeah, I was asked by the new Attorney General Eric Holder to sort of be his representative and to lead a task force, an interagency task force, to review all of the cases of, at that time, 240 detainees who were detained at Guantanamo and figure out what we're going to do with them. You know, what's the next step or what's the disposition for those individuals, given that the options were not great, you know, at that point. And Ken, you know this better than anyone because you worked on this at the end of the Bush years, you know, how hard it was, because there were hundreds of detainees who had been at Guantanamo by the time President Obama came into office, who had been released, transferred home. So we were down to 240 who you, at that point, the government had struggled really to figure out if we were going to keep them detained or release them.
Yeah, just to preview what you ended up getting in your lap, you know, toward the end of the 2008, I spent a lot of my time when I was Homeland Security Advisor working with the authorities in Saudi Arabia and Yemen to try to repatriate the 90-odd Yemenis that were in Guantanamo. That was the biggest ethnic group that we had, were all the Yemenis. And the problem was the Yemeni government didn't have the facilities to house them. So we were trying to broker something with the Saudis, thought we had something arranged, and then, of course, it fell apart at the last minute. And so, yeah, you ended up getting, was it 240, or inheriting 240 detainees with the transition from the Bush to the Obama administration. And, you know, it was a tough nut to crack to try to find a place where those people could go, where we could ensure that they wouldn't return to terrorism and pose a threat to us, but at the same time, try to deal with this the situation in Guantanamo, which everybody recognized was not sustainable ultimately.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And, you know, at the time that I took on this role, there had been a pretty strong consensus, political consensus, and just sort of, you know, within the government, within the executive branch, that, as you said, Ken, it was not sustainable to continue just to hold individuals at Guantanamo indefinitely, that there needed to be some solution that would involve prosecuting some of them, transferring some number, in some cases, to countries that were not their home countries. And then maybe, you know, there may be some number that would have to be continued to be held under the laws of war, which was the legal basis for detention for some period of time. But there was a general, I think, as I said, consensus that this was a path that we needed to take as a country.
So you undertook to review the files of all the 240-odd detainees that were still there, and then came up with dispositions for each of them. And then by the end of your time on that project, you got the number down significantly, didn't you?
Yeah. I mean, it's funny. Let me just take a step back, because you said, you know, take the files and review the files. There were no real files. Like, there was information spread out across the government on the detainees generally. Like, a lot of it was at the Defense Department, but a lot of it was in the intelligence agencies, the Justice Department, other, you know, State Department. The whole process started with trying to pull together information on who were these 240 individuals, who could we safely transfer back to their home country, who could we send to a third-party country where we might have concerns about repatriation, because in some cases, some of the detainees would be subject to persecution if they went to their home country. The Uyghurs in China were a very good example of that. In some cases, we were going to look to prosecute detainees. And there were actual ongoing criminal investigations within the Justice Department of some of them. And we had the view that there could be more of those, and they could be prosecuted in the United States or in the military commission that had been set up at Guantanamo. And as I said, then a number where we thought we were concerned we may have to be held because they couldn't be transferred safely or prosecuted. So yeah, we started with 240. We transferred out a fair number, but at this stage, I checked the other day, there's only 40 detainees left at Guantanamo. So it's really a relatively small number of individuals. And so I know there was a big push at the end of the Obama administration to move out as many as possible. And I think you'll see continued effort on this going forward.
Okay. So after that, you then get the nod to go over and be the general counsel at the National Security Agency, where you're the chief lawyer at the NSA that is just out in Maryland and is a member of the intelligence community. So why don't you just give us a couple minutes about sort of what your role was out there, what the challenges were of being a lawyer in an intelligence agency like the NSA, and how that's different from being a lawyer in DOJ, which is a department and culture all of lawyers.
Yeah, so that's a great question. And you know, first, that's the main difference, that you put your finger on it. I went from an organization where it was all about being a lawyer, the organization existed because of lawyers, that's the Department of Justice, to an organization, a vast organization, the National Security Agency, made up of computer scientists and mathematicians and analysts, a totally different set of skills, with a small legal office that I oversaw of about 100 lawyers, whose job it was, you know, fundamentally to make sure that everything the NSA did was consistent with the laws of the United States. And it was, you know, at first I wasn't sure if we were going to be sort of looked at as maybe like the adversary within the walls of the NSA, because there's going to be times when, as a lawyer, as the general counsel, I'd have to tell the director of NSA or others, you know, no, you can't do this because it would, you know, be contrary to what the law requires. But the opposite was actually true. The culture of NSA is one of like profound rule adherence to rules and desire to stay on the right side of the law and the rules. And so my job, I often found, was more trying to be clear about explaining what the laws were so that people could follow them, and having to do that honestly in an environment, a legal environment, where sometimes the law is not that clear. As we talked about with FISA, you know, there are times when the law, you know, you can, it's subject to interpretation, or it's actually changing, you know, it could be quite dynamic, you know, so what it meant, you know, a year ago might be different next year. So, you know, I found the hardest part was talking to operators at the NSA who say, hey, you know, just tell me where the line is. I'll make sure I stay on the right side of the line And, you know, that's all I want to know. And I'd have to sometimes give less than definitive answers to that question. And that, I think, that's part of the challenge of being a lawyer in an intelligence agency.
Yeah, that's an interesting observation. And I think people who've spent time dealing with legal issues in the intelligence context grow to value clarity, that what operators really want is they just want to know where the line is. Less concerned with, you know, what latitude that line allows them. They just want to know what the, where the line is. And when there's either an absence of a line or the line is blurred or hard to place, that actually causes them to be cautious and to sort of step back from the whole range of where that line might be, which is bad for national security, right? You don't want them going over the line. That's bad for, you know, constitutional concerns and people's privacy and civil liberties. But you also don't want them staying way shy of the line, because that's going to mean there's a whole range of activity that could be helpful to national security that they're not undertaking. And that that's what happens when the law isn't clear. That's some of that is just inherent in the application of law to national security operations and the vagaries of national security operations. But some of it is also the fault of legislation and rules. And that's, as we said earlier, one of the things we were dealing with FISA. One of the problems, one of the reasons why that example you used where, you know, we might have to get a FISA to surveil somebody who's a foreign person in a foreign country who's communicating with another foreign person in another foreign country, we would have to still go to the FISA court. That's because the law wasn't clear enough. And so there are real life consequences to that lack of clarity. And so I see how that you would have that special challenge when you're the one who's across the table from the operators who are saying they need to do something for national security, and they want to know exactly what they can do and can't do. And tough position to be in. That's why you need experienced people in those jobs.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. And I've talked to a lot of attorneys in national security agencies over the years, and this is a common challenge. I mean, it can be really rewarding. I think one of the things that I found to be useful was to consider yourself as a lawyer as part of a team. You know, you're on the team with the operators, with the leaders of the organization. You share a common set of objectives. You bring a certain discipline to the discussion and a certain ability to contribute around, okay, here's my assessment of where that line is, what you can do. You know, there's a risk to saying, no, you can't do it, and just putting down a firm line if there's some room. But, and there's obviously, of course, a risk if you say, yes, you can take a certain action if it's close to the line. So, you know, having strong sense of collaboration with the operators, so they're also very trustful of you and open with you about what they're, you know, exactly the activity they're going to engage in. I mean, I felt like that was a way to sort of reconcile this tension where you really are having to be as clear as possible in a landscape that is often sort of murky when it comes to cutting edge national security activities.
Yeah, I think the team analogy is just the right one, because you and the operators want the same things, right? You want to facilitate whatever steps can be taken to ensure national security, but at the same time, you don't want to be going across the line. And that's the right mindset to have on both sides, both on the operator side and the lawyer side, that you're all part of the same team with the same objective. So let's jump over to your last post in government and just sort of quickly address the National Counterterrorism Center. You were nominated and confirmed as the director of NCTC, the National Counterterrorism Center. That is a new creation. Just take a minute, tell us sort of where the NCTC came from, what its purpose was, and maybe a taste of what it was like running that shop.
NCTC, the National Counterterrorism Center, was created after 9/11. It was established in 2004, but it really was born of this fundamental observation about the failure of the government to work with unity of effort around counterterrorism. So, you know, 9/11, among other, you know, sort of reasons that we failed to stop that attack, one of them was that there really wasn't robust information sharing, particularly this line that we've talked about a number of times, Ken, over the course of this conversation between the national security side, intelligence side, and the law enforcement side. So that FBI and CIA both had information about the 9/11 hijackers, but, you know, I think it's fair to say that we didn't share that information effectively. And The 9/11 Commission came out in 2004 and recommended that NCTC and NCTC be established. That would be a hub or clearinghouse for all terrorism information and analysis. So it could sit on that domestic and foreign divide, have authority to look at all information that related to terrorism, regardless of whether it was collected in the United States or overseas. So really obliterate that distinction between the foreign and the domestic in the context of counterterrorism, so that we would be in our best position to prevent another attack carried out by people who had come into the United States with the purpose of killing Americans. So that was the genesis of the organization, and it grew over the course of a number of really amazing leaders, from John Brennan to Scott Redd and Mike Leiter. And I came in 2011 to serve as the director of an organization. By the time I came in, that was really well positioned and established to sort of carry out that mission.
Okay, so you were at NCTC then, I believe, until 2014. Is that right? Is that when you left government?
Yeah. Left in 2014.
Right, left in 2014 after 20-some years or whatever that was in government. And then you were with a cybersecurity firm with General Keith Alexander, who was the NSA director when you were the general counsel.
That's right. Yeah. I was just thinking back on having left government in 2014 and how traumatic it was, Ken, when the construction guys came into my house and removed the skiff from my attic, which became sort of this sort of sign that I had sort of become a true insider in the national security world. When I had a skiff, for those who are listening, it's a facility, basically a room where I could have classified conversations and had a computer with access to classified systems.
And probably the only reason that your kids would tell their friends that you were cool, because you had a skiff.
My youngest son, who was little at the time, was very, he found it to be endlessly mysterious and interesting that there was this special room that he was not allowed to go in the attic of our house. And so, yeah, they came and took that away, and with it, my identity to some degree,
as an illusion of cool.
Right, my illusion of cool. So I joined with Keith Alexander, who had been the director of NSA, to help start a cybersecurity software company called IronNet Cybersecurity. It's still doing great under General Alexander's leadership. And I stayed there for about 4 years before going to Uber in 2018.
Okay, so let's bring it up to today. You're still with Uber, but you also have a little extracurricular activity. You're on the President-elect Biden transition team, right? For the intelligence community?
Yes, I'm on one of the agency review teams.
So look, I'm not going to ask you questions about your transition activities today. Understand we shouldn't be putting on the spot about what's happening with the transition now, but you've been through transitions in the past. So in particular, the one from Bush to Obama. So any lessons that you learned going through that last transition? Because as you said, you were the person who was heading up the National Security Division when the new team came in.
Yeah, I think it's a great question, and there's a lot of folks in the government who've been through multiple transitions. It's an amazing feature of our country and our government that, 4-8 years, power shifts from one president and one administration to another. And it's something I think, as Americans, we can all be so proud of. And as a career DOJ person in 2008, it was really interesting for me to sit in the room as we said goodbye to our colleagues who had been in political jobs. And we said hello to a new set of political leaders coming in from a different party, and we were very proud, nonpartisan civil servants, right? Who, it doesn't matter what party you are, you're coming in as the new leadership, we are going to support you. I would say one of the experiences I had at that time was that I took with me going forward is that it's really important for the new team coming in to understand that there may be political people at the top of these organizations who are going out, but there are people who have been there as career professionals who will stay there and will continue to be there, whose job it was to carry out the mission of those departments and agencies every day, and to really trust that they were nonpartisan, are nonpartisan. They are going to support whoever is in charge, and they're going to, follow that leadership. But they also have extraordinary experience and background that needs to be, leveraged by the new team coming in. Not just leveraged, actually, but like respected and acknowledged. And I think that's a lesson I felt at the time in 2008 was really important, that that people looked at me in that way, like, tell us what's been going on here at the Justice Department, and we trust you. And something that I'm going to, you know, I think is a lesson for anyone involved in any transition.
So from where you sat, so how did you think that the transition went between the George W. Bush and Obama administrations?
Well, I mean, from where I sat, it was great. I mean, it was exactly as I think you would hope, where there's new leadership coming in with new ideas. You know, President Obama had campaigned on, you know, some changes, but, you know, you and I've talked about this too, Ken. There was largely a fair amount of continuity between 2008 and 2009 on national security issues. Certainly, there were some changes, like the Guantanamo review, for example. That was a new initiative. It built on the work of the Bush administration, but, you know, it took it a step further in a way. And I do think that there was, at first, you know, there's a sort of a sense that the new team coming in is coming in with a lot of, you know, new ideas that are important, but we also, as career people, I think, you know, it was important that the new team listened to some of the challenges that we were facing, and again, sort of respected the experience that we had had.
We actually talked about this very issue when John Bennett and I had our conversation 4 weeks ago, and you know, he actually took my position. I was the Homeland Security Advisor under Bush. He was the Homeland Security Advisor under Obama. So we had a transition from me to him, which was, of course, part of the broader Homeland Security and government transition across the board. And I think we agreed that it was a very smooth transition, largely because people on both sides did their utmost and their absolute best to try to ensure continuity, smoothness, lack of any disruptions in the handoff, and a respect for each other's positions, and going into the process with a presumption of good faith on the part of each side. And when I walked out of the White House at 2 o'clock on inauguration day and left the reins to John in the Homeland Security space, I felt like the whole experience had really affirmed my belief in American democracy, because the government at every level was transitioning just the way the American people wanted it to. And I think, my hope is that we'll continue to see that. And our hope, of course, is that you will be seeing that in the handoff that's coming on January 20th next year.
Yeah, totally agree, Ken.
So you, when you were NCTC director, you worked a lot at the White House. You briefed the president. You briefed the vice president. You got to know Joe Biden, who's going to be our president. He's somebody who got elected in large part on the basis of his experience, his ability to handle tough situations, the number of crises he's gone through in his life, and his ability to handle crises. Can you give us a little insight into what you saw when the vice president at the time, Joe Biden, was dealing with the type of crises that you were giving him intelligence briefings on?
Sure. You know, as you said, so as the director of NCTC, I had the opportunity, really the privilege, right, to be in the Situation Room briefing the National Security Council, often the president and the vice president, on counterterrorism issues and intelligence. You know, look, what I saw from then Vice President Biden was somebody who was really steeped in an understanding of foreign affairs, foreign policy, and national security, cared deeply about American troops and the deployment of American troops around the world, was a trusted partner. This came across often of the president, somebody the president turned to often sort of at the end of the meeting, you know, last to get his counsel, and clearly had an extraordinarily strong and trusted relationship between the two. So I saw extraordinary leader on these issues then Vice President Biden. I have to say the other thing is that Vice President Biden came out to NCTC when we had our 10-year celebration, our 10-year anniversary in 2014, when I was still director. And he was obviously the leading speaker at our day-long celebration. He spoke to our workforce in the auditorium. He spoke, you know, as far as I could tell, without notes for, you know, maybe 30, 45 minutes. And he talked really about the workforce, talked to the workforce about the work they do and why it was so important and why they could have done so many different things with their careers. And they chose public service and public service, you know, in national security. And I, you know, he had a remarkable impact on the workforce in the way he connected with them, in the way it was clearly a heartfelt sense of appreciation he had for their service. And you know, I was so grateful to him for serving in that role at a, you know, at a time when we were celebrating the 10th anniversary of NCTC.
That's a lovely anecdote. And those kind of appearances by the vice president or president mean so much to the folks who are in the trenches protecting our national security. So it means a lot that he did it, and he did it with such sincerity. And your observations about him in the Situation Room are consistent with the observations that we've heard from my colleague Lisa Monaco and others who work closely with him, as somebody who really understands the intelligence world, understands the national security implications of any issue that he deals with. And I think those observations bode well for the coming years. So look, I think we probably ought to wrap up pretty soon, but oh, there's one thing. We got a question from a curious listener that I think is important for me to raise with you. And this listener was reading through a book the other day and noticed a really interesting snippet that related to you. And this is a book written by a gentleman by the name of Daniel Kladman. It's called Killer Capture, The War on Terror and the Soul of the Obama Presidency. And this one snippet that the listener focused in on was one about a 47-year-old veteran prosecutor who happens to be you, who, quote, rose to the top of the Justice Department. But I think the part that really caught his attention was this part that says about you, quote, despite his thinning brown hair, Olson had more than a passing resemblance to the actor Tom Cruise. That's the part that gets me. He kept a basketball in his office, which he would roll around in his hands, just as Cruise's character had done with a baseball bat in the movie A Few Good Men. Olson was a perfect choice for the Guantanamo job. So this listener was very curious about this. And I'm a little curious too, because, you know, intelligence community officials are not usually the type of folks who get compared to movie stars. And so, like, my question is, you know, how did you get pub like this? How'd you get such good pub? I never got anything like that. Is this guy like on your payroll?
Yeah, it was an extraordinary observer, Dan Kladman. really a renowned and highly regarded journalist.
So. I'm just totally envious. The only part of that whole snippet I like is the part about the thinning brown hair. And so look, just in case you're curious, the listener who posed that really important question, that listener was our very own Preet Bharara. And I think Preet probably wants to get this guy on his payroll.
Yeah. Well, Preet is a master at himself, so we can all learn from him.
Yeah, but probably hasn't been compared to Tom Cruise. So you got that on all of us. So anyway, well done. So look, on that note, let me just say thanks. Thanks for being such a good friend over these many years. Thanks for your service. Just today's session shows the level of service that you've given to this country and the amount of sweat, blood, and tears that you put into it, and how much that's meant to our national security. And then let me also say thank you for joining us today. It's been great talking to you. And I, for one, have learned a lot. And I think I'm confident that our listeners have as well.
Great, Ken. It's been a real pleasure. It's just terrific to talk to you. The feeling's mutual. So thanks for having me.
That's it for this week's episode of the United Security Podcast. Your hosts are Lisa Monaco and Ken Weinstein. The executive producer is Tamara Sepper. The senior producer is Adam Waller. The senior audio producer is David Tatasciore. And the CAFE team is David Kurlander, Nat Wiener, Matthew Billy, Sam Ozer-Staten, Noah Azulai, Jake Kaplan, Calvin Lord, Jeff Eisenman, Chris Boylan, Sean Walsh, and Margot Malley. And our music is by Allison Leighton Brown. Thank you for being part of the CAFE Insider community.